I think we'll make a start to make sure we get a bit of time to hear remarks from Ramani and then have a discussion. This session is the GFC, or the GEC as it is now, I suppose, APRA Activities, which is basically a presentation by Ramani on a bunch of things that APRA are looking at the moment. Ramani, your presentation is going for about how long, did you say?
25 minutes.
Okay, standard 20-25 minutes, and then we'll have some question and answers along the way. It's my pleasure to introduce Ramani Venkatramani. I won't try to throw the full length name, Ramani. He's the general manager of the Central Region in the Specialised Institutions Division of APRA, and is responsible for prudential supervision of a large number of standalone superannuation funds and authorised deposit-taking institutions, ADIs. In addition to his supervisory role, Ramani chairs APRA's internal superannuation industry group, which deliberates on prudential issues that affect that industry, responds to market developments from the point of view of legislative intent and consistency of practice, and liaises with fellow regulators and industry and professional bodies. Prior to joining APRA in 98, he worked in the Insurance and Superannuation Commission, where he was responsible also for a lot of superannuation work and complex superannuation reviews. His background includes working with Standard Chartered Bank Group in India, and also the Life Insurance Corporation of India. And on the academic front, he's a fellow originally of the Institute of Actuaries in London. He also has a Bachelor of Mathematics from the University of Madras. And he also has other degrees, including a graduate diploma in legal studies from the University of Technology, Sydney. So welcome, Ramani. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg, for the introduction. I thank you all also for turning up at what seems to be like 3 o'clock in the morning. So thank you for making it. I had a bet on my way in the train that I will only speak this morning if the total number in the audience is at least equal to the total number of slides. I'm happy to say I won. So thank you very much for making it. Many of you might have thought about it, but there is a significant difference of convergence between actuaries and prudential regulators. I jotted down a few points of convergence, and I hope you will agree. There are 2 points of divergence which I'll come to. The first one is that both deal with fuzzy future rather than certainties, and they do this knowing that they do this and that it is their professional strength. The second point of convergence is that we are always judged by our failures. No one knows if a fund which you advised is solvent, but if it is insolvent, almost everyone would know. Every entity which you regulate successfully is hidden. Every entity which we try to regulate and fail is in the papers. So there again we have a level of convergence. We are all bound by the law, of course, but our brief is to go what mere law cannot achieve in terms of going into the future. The other difficulty is that we can facilitate good conduct, but we don't necessarily implement it in most of our roles. And as the last couple of months might have proved, our visibility, I won't call it popularity, our visibility is inversely proportional to the financial strength of the markets which we operate in. The two probably divergent features, or unlike you poor actuaries, in practice, your ability to get some money declines in times of stress. But as you might have noted from budget papers, our ability to get money increases in financial crisis. So there we do better than you. And finally, I don't think actuaries have really powers to enforce things. Whilst we don't do that often, we do have that power. So on that note of comparison, I thought I'll get on to my presentation. What I want to do today is talk about, in the lead-up to GEC, GFC, and during it, and now, what have I been doing in each of our regulated industries, and some of the common themes across all the industries that we regulate, and the role of professionals, in particular actuaries, what they have been doing to help, and what perhaps they can do more. And then the final point, that our well-deserved reputation, we are classed with Canada in terms of having navigated this crisis with less bruises than most of the regimes, requires constant maintenance. In terms of authorized deposit takers, I know that conventionally, actuaries are not particularly visible in this area, but that's changing very fast. In authorized deposit takers, some of the themes we have been looking at, as you would know, is our liquidity, credit quality, capital now and into the future, and of course the overarching theme of risk management, how that is embedded in the systems and processes and governance of each one of our regulated deposit takers. What did we do on liquidity? In liquidity, as soon as some of the initial storm clouds gathered, APRA set up a dedicated team drawn from our market risk, our actuarial, our frontline supervisors, and our industry experts in ADIs to seek out information, talk to major players almost on a regular basis, sometimes daily, sometimes more than once in a day, to find out about ADI funding plans, what is going on, including the stress testing which they are undertaking. And that was fed through to management, at least initially, on a daily basis, senior management looking at what's going on in the market. And the special team to monitor ADI liquidity provided feedback to our frontline supervisors across the big end of town, Diversified Institutions Division, and the small end of town, the Specialized Institutions Division, so that the frontline supervisors can send the right messages, find the right information. One of the difficulties, particularly in stress times, is that you cannot make the assumption that people will behave rationally. In fact, I see the phrase predictable irrationality in the International Actuarial Association's papers. I don't know how predictable irrationality is, but we have to provide for irrational behavior, including responses to rumors. So we have been talking to treasurers, CFOs, CEOs where necessary. And one of the things which we have found out is that our existing prudential standards, robust though they may be in relation to some other regimes, needs to be tweaked further, refined further, to provide additional information on banking liquidity. And this is something which we would be developing in consultation with industry, as we always do. The government guarantee introduced some time ago did ease the concerns. The guarantee was in two parts because of the systemic nature, or more systemic nature, of ADIs, that unwarranted rumors do not cause the very thing which everyone wants to avoid, a run on one institution contaminating the system. That was one. The second one was the ability of banks to borrow from other institutions, at least initially, was virtually nil, and the government had to follow what other governments have done to put our institutions at least in a comparable base, on a comparable basis. So that did ease things. When I talk about super and other things, I'll tell you about some of the, we'll discuss briefly some of the effects which had happened on adjoining industries. The vulnerability of the models which institutions have had, which have assumed a significant level of offshore funding, or were exposed, and we had to say, look, tell us how you will behave if these so-called committed or non-committed lines do not come through. What are your escape routes? What are your contingency plans? And internally, we increased the triggers which we had, high quality liquid asset ratio, for instance, which we would be using internally to go to the institution and ask for more information, not plans, which we can judge to be effective and have a realistic prospect of being implemented. We did not, again, as is our wont, go and prescribe it, but I think the industry knew. In fact, to the credit of the industry, I think many people in the industry themselves upped their targets, probably because of self-interest, but that aligned with APRA's prudential concerns. The second issue was credit quality. Particularly in a crisis, there is always a temptation to say, I told you so. But if you go back well before the markets started moving the way they have been moving for the last 18 months, a lot of APRA exhortations revolved around the fact that there is only one way credit quality can go. You cannot assume the Goldilocks period will continue. So that has been said by Ian McFarlane, it has been said by John Laker, it has been said by other people. So to an extent, I think this was not a new message coming through from APRA. But when the crisis hit, the exposures which rely on debt or other deteriorating industry segments, we felt could effectively bankrupt institutions. In fact, some institutions, as we would know, have been bankrupted in this process. Therefore, we provided and prepared a range of indicators, including an internal list of which institutions should be watched and with what frequency or intensity. And we talked to the institutions to apply risk grading, valuation, and appropriate and robust provisioning against problem loans, in addition to any general provisions which they might have held. One particular aspect of credit quality, of course, is commercial property. This sector has grown significantly in previous years, and the loan valuation ratios have been raising due to those three things: equity redraws increasing the exposure, interest only means that the loan is not being reduced in the normal course through amortization, and then, of course, the underlying fact of significant drop in property values. The increased exposure to commercial property also meant increases in impaired loans, particularly in the past 12 to 18 months. That graph illustrates that there has been a significant spike in commercial property and the ability of people to fund it. Around the same time when this has happened, the institutions which have traditionally been funding them have themselves been under the pump, which is not a good thing to see. Therefore, we have asked again for additional stress testing on commercial property portfolios, and in the watch list, which I referred to briefly, commercial property exposures are a dominant part, both in size and number of exposures. Capital. The general good news is that notwithstanding the tumultuous times we have gone through, the overall capital position of our ADIs remain very sound. In fact, coming from where I come from, in specialized institutions, the kind of capital which some of my institutions have are numbers for which other banks would kill. We're talking about 20%, 25%, 28%. But the real issue is not their capital. The real issue is their long-term viability. And one large exposure which they might have might tilt them. Going back to my earlier comparison, it's not that you're alive today, but how likely and what probability that you will be alive well into the future, your sustainability. But I think both the industry and ourselves realize that there is no room for complacency here. Access to additional capital has been strained, but the good news there is that many of our institutions have actually increased their capital ratios. As an example, in relation to Tier 2, APRA does not mandate that your Tier 2 should be close to 8%. There is no such requirement. But most of our banks have, on their own accord, said, look, this is what we need to do. It might have been the case, I'm a prudential regulator, therefore cynicism is part of my psychology, it might have been that the bank guarantee, which will at one point in time end, might have persuaded some of the bank CFOs to say, now it's not a bad time to go and get some capital when we are still floating on this support. But, you know, it's a good thing. And the profit growth this year would be slower, and this might continue for some more time. In terms of the major banks and the other banks, if you look at the position between 2007 and 2008, you can see the return on assets, the return on equity both dropping, and in relation to other banks significantly. Cost income ratios, outstanding or standout feature is cost income ratio for major banks seems to have dropped. Again, as a prudential regulator, what seems to be apparent good news, we would like to question some more. Are they cutting costs in essential risk management and other compliance areas? So I'm a prudential regulator, so I can be cynical. So don't come with good news and expect to walk away without some more questions. So that's a question which we do keep asking. The non-interest to total income, that has dropped significantly. And the net interest margin has held up, but the overall business itself has significantly dropped, partly because of economic activity and partly because of a higher level of conservatism on the part of lenders and credit managers. We are testing the robustness of institutional capital management plans, and we do not want this to be a written document which sits on the shelf. It needs to be revisited regularly. Some of the issues which we are looking at in that context are risk appetite, the quality of the loan portfolio, the ability of the institutional systems to identify and manage problem loans. Sometimes shining a torch on a particularly bad portfolio might be the first step, but if you do nothing about it, all that you do is to add to your depression. And provision for potential losses on a robust basis. One of the things that you also talk to institutions about is the appropriateness of their existing or declared dividend policies and any greater ability to conserve resources through constraint of dividends, which again, I think institutions have heeded. So all of that is what's happened. In general insurance, I must make a point. I mean, I myself have offered or agreed to come and present you on all the industries. But as Greg mentioned, we have got internal groups within APRA which look at industry issues, even though we regulate across all industries. I chair the superannuation group, so I have a little more familiarity with that. But in relation to ADIs, one of my colleagues, Heidi Richards, chairs it. And in relation to GIs, Helen, who's here in the audience, she chairs it. And Dennis Wilkinson, another actuary, chairs the life insurance group. I have requested their input. They are much more into this than I am. So if you have got complex or googly questions, I will go and sit in the audience and Helen can come and answer them for you. In relation to general insurance, the three areas we have been specifically looking at are solvency, downward trend in underwriting profits, and reinsurance. An introduction on the general insurance section. Since the mandated licensing of general insurance some years ago, APRA has initially, with some resistance from the industry, tried to make this industry more sophisticated, much more into the modern age. But I think that task has been well and truly won to the credit of the entities and their advisors, including actuaries. I think our general insurers now understand that some of the old methods would just not work. So when the GFC hit, I think our general insurance industry was better prepared than it could have been. So it was a good thing that we had already completed the process and we were both reading from the same page. So in terms of solvency, we tested that, and the downward trend in underwriting profits and reinsurance arrangements, including counterparty risks. In October, we surveyed the solvency position of our general insurers. The broad conclusion is that they are well capitalized. And there is a greater degree of understanding, not uniformly, of course, of stress testing and robust contingency plans. Again, some general insurers have gone to recapitalize themselves using market opportunities. I did say not all. The stress testing so far has been done or done more robustly in respect of the larger insurers. Now, that's good. But the smaller insurers have less ability to withstand stresses, so that's something which we'll continue to work on. In terms of underwriting profits, these are tied to a large number of domestic developments. There have been a number of disasters, and the market competition following the previous strengthening of regime have meant there has been some effect of such competition. And then there is this concern that underwriting profits are not likely to recover anytime soon. Downward trends in pricing, people operate in commercial markets, continuation of current prospects for further deterioration in claims experience, and then the general economic climate, meaning that people are more likely to be underinsured or uninsured. I mean, one of the things which, I mean, I'm not a GI expert, but one thing which concerns me is, have we seen the full impact of the GEC or GSC on the general insurance industry, or are we likely to see a lag effect sometime down in the future as the real economy, when it goes down or contracts, then the effect will come through, say, after some time. So my, again, cynical predilection is that we need to be prepared for that in claims experience. We have also been considering the spread of underwriting profit reductions across general insurers. We're looking at business concentrations and the related capital charges, and then the virtuous cycle, as they refer to, of good underwriting, good pricing, and good claims management, whether that is being practiced rather than being talked about. Group supervision in general insurance. From March of 2009, we have made our position clear. There is nothing like, you know, learning from other people's mistakes. If there is a rump of a business which we think we are regulating but which is unregulated and which takes on risks which can contaminate the rest of the group, think AIG, that is going to bring down the whole group. So we need to consider and make sure that the boards and management consider all risks which might flow back to the group and contaminate otherwise well-maintained parts or seemingly well-maintained parts. So the consolidated supervision of insurance groups has been introduced from end of March this year. In life insurance, our major issue has been in relation to capital adequacy. Again, I think life insurance, following the tumultuous and chastening experience, not only here but around the world, of guaranteed contracts and the need for having robust capital, a process of de-risking has been taking place. For example, at the beginning of the global financial crisis, we found that the exposures to equities of our life insurers was only of the order of about 20% on an average, a lot less than many other life insurers. So the life insurance industry was on its way to dealing with this, thanks to the industry again and their professional advisors. I think they could see what could happen, again, looking overseas. So capital adequacy was our main issue in life insurance. In early 2008, we tested the sensitivity of capital to adverse equity markets, interest rates, swaps, exchange rates, a whole range of variables. And we wanted the insurers to come and tell us what their position would be and what their contingency plans are. Like in ADIs, we created an internal team to monitor capital and make sure that the responses are coordinated across APRA and are tailored to our risk assessment of individual institutions. And in December last year, we sent out a stress test survey on all insurers. The results have come in and they are being currently looked at. And the overall conclusions are not all that satisfactory. Broadly, the life insurance industry remains well capitalized despite volatile markets. Given that conventionally actuaries are associated more with insurance than other parts, even though they should not be, I think a large part of this credit can go to the profession and the various managers. We will continue to monitor capital and work with institutions based on the stress test on a case-by-case basis, depending on our assessment of risk. So there's not going to be a standard approach. So some people will get more service for the same fee which they pay. That's one great thing with APRA. We provide you additional service, but we don't send you a bill, except next year when our costs are measured against on a post-factor basis. And identified high-risk insurers are providing weekly reporting. In super, the three areas are liquidity, valuation of unlisted assets, and solvency of DB funds. In March 2008, when APRA floated that maybe super funds should move away from this construct, that because of this relentless pumping of the SG machine, superannuation will never have a liquidity problem. We need to move away with that construct. Initially, that notion was met with a lot of cynicism, even on the part of what we would call responsible industry leaders. You don't want us to be like banks. We are not general insurers. We have SG. But what has happened is like building a house with a small foundation, tender foundations, and then keeping on adding additional superstructures to it. This industry, which started off with SG, a single trustee responsible for a single investment strategy, has moved away from that model. We now have many investment options. We have portability. We have members who can be pensioners and accumulators at the same time. Tax concessions have made that it's much better for you to, particularly as you grow from 55 to 60, to salt away most of your super, most of your assets into super. So all of this has completely changed the structure. I think there is not much of a debate now that liquidity is an important risk which trustees need to consider and manage. I'll share an almost impossible statement which I received. Oh, we are a DB fund and we cannot have a liquidity problem. I said, so you pay your benefits in what? In the hereafter? So liquidity is one issue. Valuation of unlisted assets, again I'll come to that in a moment, and solving the risk of DB funds. We sent out a survey in May 2008 and in order to understand how liquidity was being managed. Now, that was a mixed picture. You must remember that that was the early stages of this evolving crisis, and many people legitimately, bona fide, believed that there was not a problem. And, for example, one of the standard responses was, we will ask our advisors what we should do about it. So, from that, and some standard responses, and we could actually see that these responses were not coming from the trustees and the responsible people, but by the advisors, because identical wording was used on several of them. So cut and paste. So that was an interesting response. We stressed the need to understand member demographics. I mean, one issue which Melinda Hose in her session mentioned, which bears repeating, is that the only liquidity which matters in a fund is the liquidity at the fund option, the investment option level. The fact that you're swimming in liquidity in other parts does not necessarily mean, without creating huge inequities and being exposed perhaps to legal action, that a trustee can simply say, overall the fund has got liquidity, therefore it doesn't matter that particular options, particularly their large options, are illiquid. Rigorous scenario analysis is still a work in progress in superannuation under a range of extreme but plausible scenarios. Having said all that, I think compared to the panic which, you know, sometimes media understandably spreads, the overall response has been both reasonable, responsible, and proportionate. We were pleased to see that some very large funds were going beyond what their legal obligations were, even when the underlying investment options were frozen. I mean, one of the issues as a result of the government guarantee, as we all know, was at the edges, funds which mimicked deposits like mortgage funds, which did not have the guarantee protection, they came under pressure. People shifted to bank deposits. There, I think, the response of the industry was very good. And one of the things which we did in APRA as soon as this happened, just as we created special teams in other industries, in super we created a team to look at requests for dispensations, for freezing particular payments, or exemptions from portability requirements. And there have been days when we have been working through weekends to provide those dispensations, just to calm the market. I mean, one of the things which we have said to trustees is come and talk to us early. Just don't come to me on a Friday evening at 5:30 and say, can I have a dispensation, please? We'll give it to you. That has been quite responsible position. We also looked at some of these other things, robustness of contingency plans. One of the issues is the consequence of member investment choice. This global financial crisis has unearthed a number of myths. One of those myths is that you can't have unfettered investment choice and you can also have your money whenever you want it. Another myth, those of us who might have got a sense of funny humor like me, is that John Maynard Keynes is actually dead. I think he reincarnated as a Buddhist. Sometimes he's very much back, more alive than most economists today. Member investment choice has got consequences. We do need to rethink how much of freedom people should have. We have now got an opportunity, as you might have seen, we have been asked to consider this investment circular in the context of broader issues like environmentally sustainable investment, etc. As part of that, we'll be looking at what kind of constraints would be appropriate for trustees to put on themselves. An important issue is the need for looking at strategic asset allocation. SIS says that you have to have an investment strategy, and if you have an investment strategy, disclose it and implement it. Members cannot sue you with the benefit of hindsight. But lots of those investment strategies went out of their strategic asset allocation, potentially exposing trustees to member action with the benefit of hindsight. So we have to say, look, you cannot set and forget. Pension payments produced another issue. They are a little more vulnerable than other members who are simply asking to change money from one fund to the other. They need the money for living. So again, that has not been as bad as foreseen. We have provided case-by-case relief, but a good prudential regulator never gives anything without thinking about what he can do or what she can do to drive home the message. As a completely separate exercise, we have instructed our frontline supervisors that every fund which has had this exemption would have their pace and source assessed. And we go to them after we have given them relief, saying, look, how did you get here? Take us through this. So two different approaches. So that is still coming.
Ramani, we only got about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
So
I should be finished. Okay. In respect of valuation of unlisted assets, this issue is very well known to this profession. We have very recently provided additional guidance, and we have copied it to all the stakeholders, including the Institute of Actuaries. I'm actually meeting with Andrew Bowl and the SEBPC on 1st of May to talk to them about our intent and wish to work with the profession. I'm actually meeting tomorrow with the accountants and a few other people, so this is an ongoing approach. Our letter and our guidance is reasonably detailed, so I would be grateful if the profession can consider that and appropriately advise trustees. DB funds, again, as expected, there has been a lot of funds in unsatisfactory financial position and a handful in technical insolvency. Our reach, as you all know, is only with reference to MRBs. Again, the good news is trustees and their advisors, including actuaries, have been very proactive on this, and the overall picture is not as dire as, again, in our worst nightmares we think of. We have sent this very strong message that you need to liaise with them, and APRA supervisors will be talking to them where there is close to technical insolvency or actual technical insolvency. There is always a possibility that some of these funds may not be able to survive and they may have to convert to accumulation. I will finish my speech with this eternal quote: if winter comes, can spring be far behind? That rhetorical question, those who are minded in a poetic and literary way, is that no, if winter comes, spring can be far behind. But again, another similarity between actuaries and prudential regulators, I would say yes. Therefore, on that sober and conservative note, I will exhort the actuarial profession to work with APRA in navigating these difficult times. Thank you.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes for questions, so if anybody's got any questions from the floor. Sure. To the microphone, if you'd just say your name, please.
I'm Bob Stribling. I'm going to show my ignorance here because I don't know if Rudd Bank has actually been created as a legal entity yet, but is this something that you could share any comments on in terms of APRA's engagement in thought process around the Rudd Bank and its potential to help manage commercial property lending exposures in the country?
I can give you an APRA perspective. Whether it is commercial property lending or any other part of the economy, the government has got a broader brief than APRA. Government's brief is to manage the economy as a whole, including starting off moribund sections of the economy. That's clearly the government mandate. APRA's mandate is much narrower. We need to make sure that our institutions participate in national endeavors of this kind in a responsible, risk-assessed fashion. So to an extent, you can even say that there is a little bit of a creative tension between, you know, this being a complete runaway success and APRA making sure that the institutions who participate in this are doing this in a responsible and prudent fashion. We will not shy away from that mandate of talking to them and finding out what are the risks, what are the controls, what is the capital, what are the processes. So our view is that that is a legitimate part of the government's job. We recognize that and we understand the importance of that. But in talking to our lending institutions who participate in that, we are not going to suggest or tolerate any standards being lowered. I don't know whether that helps the question that you asked.
Good morning. My name is Mark Lawrence. You talked about stress tests for insurers last year, and I just have a couple of questions. If you could say just a little more about those stress tests, given the high visibility going on with capital stress testing in the United States and so forth now, and the new Basel Committee stress test requirements, recent sort of paper for a comment discussion late last year. Those stress tests for insurers, were they... First of all, was it a common set of stress tests for all insurers? Were they macroeconomic stress tests, you know, around GDP and you know, so forth, unemployment and so on? And are those stress tests, the details of those, published anywhere? Not the results, but the actual tests themselves. Thank you.
I'm not sure that we have published the details of stress tests, but our stress tests with reference to insurers were much more aligned to the existing state of those insurers. I mean, APRA, after all, has got an ongoing record of risk assessments, and you might consider it, you know, flicking the task to somebody else. Essentially, the approach has been to go to the boards, chief actuaries or appointed actuaries, and say, how have you stress-tested it? What are the tests you have undertaken, why, and what are those results, and talk to individual institutions. Obviously, if there are aspects which have been missed, we would be talking to them about it. But we have not taken on these massive things. I mean, one of the things which we did when we decided to start the test testing, particularly with reference to life insurance, we said that when the ASX 200 hits 5,000, we will have to go in and find out. And that happened quite some time ago. And we said, look, take us through what has happened and what will happen if it goes down further as it has done. So it was a tailored approach to each individual institution. Helen, would you like to add to it?
You have to make it quick, Susan, because they're going to chuck us out in a sec. Okay, I think we have to call it a day there because the next group want to come in. So if you could join with me.